I want to finish up the study on money management today, and I want to open with just reading you the lyrics of my favorite song in the whole world, and that is a song called Satisfied Mind by Johnny Cash. It's actually originally by Porter Wagner, which I didn't realize until I looked up the lyrics, which I don't even know who Porter Wagner is, but anyway, I can't imagine that he could have done a better job of singing it than Johnny Cash did. So I'm just going to read it to you. I won't sing it to you. I will spare you that. It says, how many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do things my way. But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in 10 with a satisfied mind. Once I was winning in fortune and fame, everything that I dreamed for to get a start in life's game. Then suddenly it happened, I lost every dime, but I'm richer by far with a satisfied mind. Money can't buy back your youth when you're old, or a friend when you're lonely, or a love that's grown cold. The wealthiest person is a pauper at times, compared to the man with a satisfied mind. When my life has ended and my time has run out, my friends and my loved ones, I'll leave, there's no doubt. But one thing's for certain, when it comes my time, I'll leave this old world with a satisfied mind. How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do things my way? But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in 10 with a satisfied mind. You see why that's my favorite song now? Last week we left off talking about how it's not necessarily a sign of a lack of spirituality or godliness for a Christian to be poor. And we never want to look at somebody who is poor, especially a Christian is poor, and then conclude from that, well, he must not be a godly man or else the Lord would have prospered him. He must be doing something wrong. It's not necessarily indicative. But it is indicative of a lack of spirituality or godliness if a Christian is poor due to laziness, wastefulness, foolishness, or imprudence. So if you do stupid things and get yourself into poverty, then it is a shame to be in poverty. But if it's due to no fault of your own, then that's a different story. Let's look at a few verses here. It talks about laziness. If you're lazy, the chances are you're going to be poor. I just have a slew of them here, starting in Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. Solomon has a lot to say about this topic of wealth management, for that matter, and of hard work and laziness and that kind of thing. It says in Proverbs 6, 9 through 11, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? And when wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Solomon here is talking to the guy, the sluggard, who's lazy and just sleeps all the time. And he says if you sleep all the time, your poverty will come on you. And he says two things here. It will come as one that traveleth. The old traveler man, he's coming eventually. We don't know when he's coming, but he is coming for sure. So it's going to come. And secondly, it's going to come with a vengeance, and thy want as an armed man. It's going to come with power, and you're going to lose what you have. Look at Proverbs 10 and verse 4. Proverbs 10 and verse 4 says, he becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. You've heard the term slacker before, right? I think I actually got this from Austin when he did his little exhortation. I hadn't thought about this before. You deal with a slack hand, you're a slacker, and slackers are going to become poor. Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 4. Proverbs 13, 4 says, the soul of the sluggard desireth and hath nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat. So the lazy guy still desires to have everything else that he has, and generally he can at least get up off of his butt and go to the voting booth and vote for the government to take it from somebody else and give it to him. He still wants it, but he's not going to get it a lot of times, at least not honestly. But look at the contrast there. The soul of the diligent shall be made fat. So if you want to be prosperous, you got to work hard for it. I mean, this is just common sense. And that's a lot of what the Proverbs are. It's just common sense. Solomon just observed how life worked out there, and then he put it down in a bunch of pithy comments, and so that we can memorize them and use them and make ourselves more wise that way. Look at Proverbs 19 and verse 15. It says, slothfulness, which is laziness, Slothfulness casteth into a deep sleep, and an idle soul shall suffer hunger. That's the way it used to work. When you sat around and didn't do anything, you didn't eat. And the Bible talks about that. He that should not, or he that will not work, should not eat. And we'll get into that verse in a little bit. That link has been broken now between not working and eating. That doesn't happen anymore because of government programs and such. The best thing that we could do for inner cities, and, you know, it's rampant among the black communities, especially in the inner cities, not just black communities, but other ones. The reason why they're in so much trouble is because of welfare. Just get rid of welfare, and that problem would erase itself very quickly. Or else you'd have maybe a lot of crime, and they would go rob somebody for it. But eventually, if you crack down on the crime and took away the welfare, they'd move out of those slums too. You wouldn't be focused in city centers because city centers are welfare centers. They would move. They'd go somewhere and get a job. They'd have to. It's the best thing you could do for them. You know, I wonder, and I, like old Clive and Bundy said, that guy out there in Nevada, he had the ranch out there that the feds came in and tried to take over, and he got himself in all kinds of trouble, and I may have said this before, but when he said, I'm just a wondering, he's like, are the black people in slavery now more than they were back then? Which was worse, slavery, like forced slavery then, or welfare slavery now? I don't know, I would say they're probably worse off now. At least back then they had families. Their divorce rates were the same as white people's divorce rates. They were just like the rest of us. They were just discriminated against, unfortunately. They were treated terribly, but they were good people, and they were moral people, and they were, most of them, Christian. A lot of them were Christian people. And what's changed? The welfare state has changed. Giving them a check has changed. Encouraging them to have children out of wedlock, then they get more checks. I mean, when you subsidize something, you get more of it, right? You can blame the government for all those problems. Anyway, that's not what I'm talking about this morning. Proverbs, 1915, we already got that one. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. I have a lot to say, so I probably shouldn't chase too many rabbits. It says, the sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold, therefore shall he beg and harvest, and have nothing. See, back whenever things were in an agrarian society, you better go out there in the springtime and start plowing and get that seed sown in the field, or else you're not going to have a harvest whenever it comes to the harvest time. So when he says, oh, it's too cold out there, oh, it's rainy, it's cloudy, it's dangerous, there's a lion in the way. It's, you know, it's, remember the sluggard says there's a lion in the way? It's just too dangerous out there, I can't get out there and sow. Well, you're not going to reap either. That's what's going to happen. And I've told you the story about me with the working on the escort in the snowstorm when it was out there snowing. I thought, you know, by reason of the cold, I'm not going to fix my car. I'm just going to keep driving it tomorrow, and it would have probably blown up. And then I remembered this verse, and I went out there and found out what was wrong with it. So anyway, look at Proverbs 21 and verse 25. Proverbs 21, 25. The desire of the slothful killeth him, for his hands refuse to labor. See, like I said before, he's got the same desire. He just doesn't want to work for it. And his desire kills him. And if his desire doesn't kill him, he'll probably kill somebody else for whatever he wants. And Proverbs 23 and verse 21. Proverbs 23 and verse 21. It says, for the drunkard and the glutton shall come to poverty, and drowsiness shall clothe a man with rags. If you're sleeping all the time and not working, you're going to be clothed with rags. You're going to be poor. Now, if you're lazy and you don't work when you can work, you should not eat. And this is the thing. If you're looking for a job and you can't find one, that's a different story. You know, if you can't work for some reason, if you're physically disabled, that's a different story. But if you can, if somebody offers you a job and you don't take it, that's a different story. Then you should not eat. Look at 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. Paul says, for even when we were with you, we commanded you that if any would not work, neither should he eat. That verse there pretty well destroys the idea of socialism. If you're wasteful, you will likely be poor. Look at Proverbs 12 and verse 27. I know I've said a lot of these things before, and, you know, the wise scribe brings out things both new and old, and I'm going to keep on harping because it needs harped on. Proverbs 12 and verse 27. says, the slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting, but the substance of a diligent man is precious. Look at the contrast between the lazy guy and the hard worker. The lazy guy, he just goes out there and shoots a deer and leaves it lay there because he's too darn lazy to skin the thing and to quarter it and to process it. He's that, I don't feel like doing that. But the diligent man, his substance is precious. He's not going to waste anything. And I'll tell you to everybody's credit in this church, when I mentioned about wasting food a while back, I think I got more response over the course of months from that comment than probably anything else I've said. It's like everybody heard that, and now everybody's afraid to eat with me. They're like, oh, I feel if I leave some little speck on my plate, pastor's going to yell at me or something. But anyway, I'm glad that you heard me. I'm glad that people were paying attention. That's encouraging. Look at Proverbs 18 and verse 9. Proverbs 18 and verse 9. He also that is slothful in his work is brother to him that is a great waster. You show me a lazy guy, I'll show you somebody that wastes stuff, food or whatever. Or vice versa. Show me a guy that wastes something and I'll show you a lazy guy. There's a link there that the Bible makes. Now if you're foolish with your money or your investments or your business ventures, you will likely be poor. And I got a verse for that. Look in Proverbs 13 and verse 23. Proverbs 13:23. This is an application I'm going to make to this verse anyway. It says, much food is in the tillage of the poor, but there is that is destroyed for want of judgment. You know, most starvation in the world is not caused by droughts. It's not caused by, field that just won't grow food or something. It's caused by governments and wars. That's what most starvation is caused by. But if you apply this verse like I'm applying it here, your average person has much tillage. I mean, there's many things that they can do if they're just wise and make reasonable decisions. And you can go out there and you can earn a living. There's generally much opportunity available. I mean, it's a little harder. This economy is kind of rough, but in general. But there is that which is destroyed for want of judgment. You go out there and make these harebrained ideas with these business ventures or investing in foolish things or whatever, then a lot of times that's going to be destroyed. What could have been there for you will be destroyed because of your lack of judgment. Now, if you love pleasure and the finer things of life, chances are you will be poor as well. Or maybe you'll think you're rich. I don't know. Maybe you just enjoy the finer things of life and you're never going to have a penny. You're going to die a pauper and your kids will take care of you. But at least while you lived, you felt like you were rich anyway. But that's not what the Bible teaches to do. Proverbs 21 and verse 17. Proverbs 21:17 says, he that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich. So if you like to go out to eat, especially at expensive restaurants, and you get yourself a glass of wine or a beer or whatever, every time you go out to eat in an appetizer, and you're dropping, 30, 40 bucks a meal, and you like to do that kind of thing, well, chances are if you do that very often, you're going to be a poor man. I'm not saying you can never do that. It's good to go out and celebrate. It's good to enjoy the fruits of your labor. I'm not saying to never do that kind of thing. But if that's what you like to do, and if you're enjoying that kind of fine wine every night at home, well, you're probably not going to have a lot of money. And more than likely, if you like the fine wine, you're going to like the fine cars, and you're going to like the big house, and you're going to like the everything else that goes along with living the high life. And, you're going to look to everybody else like you're rich, but you're going to be poor. Look at all these people. Go to some of these nice neighborhoods. Those people probably don't have a penny to their name. They get a whole lot of debt and nothing. And actually, I will prove it to you with statistics. I have some for you. You know, I like statistics. So it's best to neither be rich nor poor, but to be in that middle station of life. Anybody ever read Robinson Crusoe? You remember the book with the guy on the deserted island? His father taught him when he was a young man, he wanted to go out there and kind of break free and go out there and make his way and have some adventure on the sea. He wanted to be a seafaring man, and his father told him, take the middle station of life. You don't want to do this. This is a dangerous way of life. But he didn't listen. And he ends up, if I remember right, it's been a while, but ended up on being a slave, I think, and then got out of the slavery, and then ended up shipwrecked on a deserted island, and then he was there for years. And I still haven't finished the book. I have it on my iPhone. I read it just in my spare time whenever I don't have anything else to do, which isn't all that often. But anyway, so Robinson Crusoe's father was very wise to tell him middle station of life, because that's what the scripture teaches. Look at Proverbs 30 and verse 8 and 9. Proverbs 30 and verse 8 and 9. He says, "Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee, and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal, and take the name of my God in vain." So the proverbist here, his name was Eger, he thought that it would be better to not have poverty nor riches. And this is what he prayed for. And I pray for the same thing. I don't want to be poor. I mean, there are blessings to being poor, I suppose. But I don't particularly want to be poor. But I honestly don't want to be rich either. I think I told some of you there that if somebody offered me $100 million, you probably won't believe this, but I honestly would not take it because it would ruin my life and all of your lives. Because it doesn't matter if I'm a $100 million heir. I believe I'm called to preach to this church, so I'm going to preach this church anyway. It doesn't matter how much money I had. That would be immaterial. But what would happen if I had inherited $100 million? Every one of you would think, well, you've got $100 million, Pastor. You'd give me $1 million, and you'd give each one of us $1 million, and then we'd all be better off. Right. And then all of you could go out there and blow that $1 million as fast as you could, and you could vacation and not be in church and everything else, and it would ruin the church. So that's why I don't want $100 million. And then if I said, no, I'm not giving you anything, oh, you miser, what, you know, you're not generous or whatever. You know how it would be. So anyway, I don't want $100 million. $1 million would be fine. I've said this before. $1 million would be fine. I could build us a little church building, you know, and maybe have a little house for myself, and that'd be all right. And I could afford to maintain it and keep it up and all that kind of stuff. But not $100 million. So anyway, like I said, I'm chasing too many rabbits. I gotta continue here. Jesus taught us to pray for our what bread?
Daily
bread. He didn't say, Lord, give us our yearly bread, our lifetime bread, or Lord, don't give me any bread at all, I want to be poor. He didn't say that. He said, give me my daily bread. That's in Matthew 6 and verse 11. The idea is there that you ask God just for what you need for the day. Don't pray to God, Lord, I just pray that you'll give me all the money that I need to take care of me for the rest of my life. You can give me some inheritance or something. Don't pray for that. Just pray that God will provide for your needs for today. It says in Matthew 6 and verse 11, give us this day our daily bread. We should be content with food and clothing. If that's all we had, we should still be content with that. That's what the Bible says is necessary for contentment in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 8. And with the way that some things look in the future, we may get an opportunity to learn to be content with food and raiment. And then that will separate the men from the boys, so to speak, when it comes to Christians being content. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 8, and having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. Food and clothing. Could you be content with food and clothing? Well, I suppose if it was a three-piece suit and steak dinner every night, right? Isn't that how we think? But could you seriously be content with food and clothing? If you had a place to stay, a roof over your head maybe? Might be difficult, but I bet you could adjust if you had to. Next thing we need to look at is we need to be good stewards of what God has given to us. So when God gives you something, he expects you to take care of it in his stead. Saving and investing money is commended by God. And I'm not going to read these passages. I made reference to them on Wednesday in the Bible study as well. But in Matthew 25, 14 through 30, you have the parable of the talents, where the Lord gives 5 talents to one man, 2 talents to another, 1 talent to another. There's kind of a play on words there, I think. A talent was a weight of gold, but a talent is also talents, right? Things that you can do. So think about it. It's God giving you talents and using your talents for him, not just the money that he gives you, but you could apply it either way. So anyway, you remember the story. The one guy went, and it says by trading, he got 5 more talents. The other guy, by trading, got 2 more talents. And what did the Lord say to him? Well done, thou good and faithful servant, enter into the joy. Or thou hast been faithful with few things, be thou ruler over many things. So the Lord commended him for trading. So trading and investing and trying to increase your wealth is a godly thing. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It can be a dangerous thing depending on what you invest in and how you do it, and that's why prudence is the word of the day for that. But then there was the other parable of the pounds, sort of a similar parable, where he gave each of them a pound. They did some trading. The one guy turned his pound into 10 pounds. The other guy turned his pound into 5 pounds. And the other guy hid his pound in a napkin. Same with the parable of talent. Hid it in a napkin. And Jesus chastised the guy that hid the pound in the napkin. He didn't go blow it. I mean, he at least returned the pound. He returned the talent. But Jesus said, you ought to have taken this and traded, or at least you should have put it in the bank where you could have got interest, usury. So at a minimum, you should have done something with it. So this is what I'm trying to tell you is this is commended by God, saving and investing. It's the fool that spends everything that he makes. Look in Proverbs 21 and verse 20. So if you are living from paycheck to paycheck and not saving any money, God says that you are a fool. That's what God says. Proverbs 21 and verse 20. Proverbs 21 and verse 20. There's treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. It's the fool that spends everything. It's the wise man that has some oil and some treasure laid up in his house. He's been saving some things. He hasn't consumed everything that he's earned. He saves some of it, consumes some of it. But the fool spends it all up. He's got no rainy day fund whatsoever. The Bible says it's a strong man that retains riches. Look in Proverbs 11 and verse 16. Proverbs 11 and verse 16 says, a gracious woman retaineth honor, and strong men retain riches. What's that tell you about the person that doesn't retain riches, that spends everything he makes, that can't hold on to anything? He's weak. So the Bible says, as cutting as this may be, that if you don't save money and you can't hold on to money, you're a weak fool. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be called a weak fool. Now, if we're to have wealth, it has to be worked for. Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 11. You say, okay, so you're telling me I got to get some money saved up. How do I do that? Well, you got to work for it. And if you work for money, if you work for wealth, it'll last. But if you get money the other way, like luck or lottery or inheritance or that kind of thing, it always doesn't last, or sometimes doesn't last. Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 11. It says, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. It says in another place, in all labor, oh, it's in verse chapter 14, 23, in all labor there is profit. I'm going to get to that. I just got ahead of myself. Almost stole my punchline. Anyway, so the verse that I was getting at there, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished. So, and you've seen it, right? You've heard the stories of people winning the lottery and winning buku bucks, millions, hundreds of millions, and I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of them end up totally broke within a few years. You think, how in the world could you blow that kind of money? They're idiots. The thing is, if you didn't have money to start with, you probably didn't know how to manage it. When you give a fool a bunch of money, then he doesn't know how to manage the money he has. Guess what? He's going to blow it too. Gone. Remember Dumb and Dumber? One of my favorite movies. I shouldn't even admit that in this company. But remember Dumb and Dumber when they get the briefcase? I think it had $1 million in it. And they finally crack that thing open and find all the money. And they're like, "Pooh!" You know, dollar signs in their eyes. And they say, we're going to be meticulous. We're going to keep records. Every single penny we borrow out of here, we're going to pay back. And they go to the mall. They get these crazy flashy clothes. They're driving around in a Lamborghini. They're, you know, handing out $500 tips to all the bellboys and just blowing it left and right. And they've got a whole suitcase full of IOUs. And then at the end, you know, when the guy comes back to get his money and he opens it up, he's like, what's this? It's full of just paper. Oh, those are IOUs, sir. And they're just as good as money. See this one? 250 thou. Might want to hold on to that one. You remember that? So anyway, that's what idiots do whenever they get a bunch of money. You never thought that I could use Dumb and Dumber to prove a scriptural principle, did you? But anyway, so don't be dumb and dumber. Now, someone that comes into great wealth through inheritance will likely lose it just as quickly. Look at Proverbs 20 and verse 21. And there's something wrong with me if I can quote that movie verbatim like that, having not seen it for years. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. And by the way, I do not endorse everything that is in that movie either. That's just a disclaimer. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. I've heard of some of the movies you all have watched, so I'm probably in the clear. Proverbs 21 and verse 20. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. How many kids have gotten a big inheritance from their parents and it's gone. They've got all a house full of nice fancy furniture and a big fancy car and this and that, and taking all their buddies out, and you know, and the whole round's on me for the whole bar or whatever, and it's gone in no time. The prosperity of fools, we're told in Proverbs 1:32, shall destroy them. Prosperity of fools shall destroy them. That's why the worst thing you could do to a lot of people would be to give them a big pile of money. You'd end up ruining them. That would probably be the worst thing you could do to somebody that doesn't know how to manage money. Now, talk is cheap. And people that usually talk about making money normally don't have any. Now, people that have money, they don't talk about making money. They just go make it. But people that talk about, I'm going to start this business. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And they're always going to do something, but they never actually do anything. Proverbs 14 and verse 23. You've heard the saying, talk is cheap. Proverbs 14, 23. In all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury. That's an old word for poverty. So if you work, in labor there's profit. It doesn't matter what the job is. It doesn't matter if you're flipping burgers at McDonald's. There is profit in labor. There's no such thing as a job that is beneath a Christian. Maybe you're more qualified for another job, but maybe you can't get another job at this point. There's no job that is underneath a Christian. No honest job, anyway. Now, if you're, you know, a call girl or a pimp or something like that, that's obviously a job that is beneath a Christian. But that's not because it's because of the nature of the work. It's because it's ungodly and immoral, not because of, you know, you're being lazy or something. You remember Karl Marx? Everybody know who Karl Marx is? Karl Marx's wife allegedly exhorted him to quit writing so much about capital and actually go and work and earn some. I couldn't find the quote I looked for. I've heard several people make reference to this happening, but anyway, that's what she told him. Because, you know, he was the writer for communism, right? And he would always talk about capital and the evil of capital. And she says, hey, Carl, why don't you go earn some? Quit talking about it. Now, it's wise and godly to save money and not spend everything we make. So I'm going to tell you why you should save money and the things that you should save money for. First of all, first and foremost, we ought to give a portion of our income to God. Look at Proverbs 3, 9 through 10. Proverbs 3, 9 through 10. I could have preached almost this entire two-part series from one of those little wee Psalms and Proverbs things, New Testament. Most of the, half the verses in this study were in Proverbs. Proverbs 3, 9 through 10 says, honor the Lord with thy substance, and with the first fruits of all thine increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. So, who gets first dibs on your income? God. It says your first fruits. Back whenever these people were farmers, the first fruits would be when the field first produces, the first thing you take off of it, that's the first fruits, and that part went to the Lord. He got his part first. Look at 1 Corinthians 9, 7 through 14. Now, as you remember, I preached on giving to God a while back. I'm not going to obviously re-preach that whole sermon. Part of that first fruits going to the Lord would go to me as your minister. Proverbs 9, 7 through 14. And this is not some plea to get money. I've told you that you people support me well. But if it applies to anybody individually, it applies. 1 Corinthians 9, 7 says, who goeth a warfare at any time at his own charges? Who planteth the vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. Just like you wouldn't expect a soldier to go out there and go to war at his own, on his own dime. You wouldn't expect somebody to keep a vineyard and not eat of the fruit of the vineyard, or keep a flock and not take milk for himself. The same way, you wouldn't expect a man to labor in the word and then not be partaker of the material benefits from the church that he spiritually feeds, is what Paul is getting at here. He says in verse 11, if we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal things? I should have just read that verse. That's basically what I was trying to say. If others be partakers of this power over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple, and they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar? So it worked this way back in the law of Moses. When the priest, when they would offer the sacrifices, they would get to take some of that for themselves. They'd get a portion of that. They'd live off the altar. Even so, Paul says, hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. We should also save for a rainy day and for retirement. Look back in Proverbs 6. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, it tells us. So we can go back to these silly little ants and we can learn things from them because they are smarter than we. And I'll prove it to you. I've got statistics to prove it to you. Proverbs 6:6-9 says, go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. When's the last time you looked at an anthill and just considered how these little ants provide for themselves and they all work together and they're not out there, you know, having their hand out for a welfare check. They take care of themselves. Verse 7, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, they don't even need a government to tell them to do this, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Go to the ant. Learn from the ant. Look in Proverbs 30 and verse 25. The ant provides for her needs. She's out there working feverishly whenever there's money, whenever there's food to be had, and then they store it up in the anthill and then they eat it all winter long. Go to the bee, thou sluggard. Bee runs out there working his little tail off. He only lives, I don't know, a few weeks, poor guy. But he goes out there and he gets all this nectar and he turns it into honey and he puts the honey in the bee's nest, and then thanks to the providence of God, he puts more in there than he actually needs, and then we can take the rest of it. But the little bee runs out there, he just runs like crazy and storing up that food for the wintertime. Why? Because he doesn't have a government to wait on. He's got to take care of himself. Look at Proverbs 30 and verse 25. The answer, a people not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. There's little wee ants. They're not anything to look at, really. They're not strong, but they're wise enough to prepare their food and to save it up for a time to come. So why do ants know how to lay up for the future, but most Americans don't? Why is that? Why are most Americans stupider than an ant? You know how big an ant's brain is? I can't imagine it's bigger than a speck of sand. Probably not even that big. And yet, they're smarter than we are. You say, well, that's harsh to say. Well, let me give you the statistics that'll prove it. This is from Statistic Brain Research Institute. It's a thing called American Family Financial Statistics. This is current information, April 27th, 2015, just a few months old. It says the average American family savings account balance is $3,950. About $4,000 is the average savings account balance for the average American. Is yours higher or lower than that? If it's lower than that, that means that you're worse than half of these stupid Americans. $3,900. Basically, so you've got $3,900 rainy day fund. You are one air conditioning unit in your house away from poverty. You are one blown engine in your car away from out on the street with your hand out. One roof on your house leaking away from total poverty. The percentage of working Americans who are not saving for retirement is 40%. Working people not saving for retirement, almost half of them are not saving for retirement, 40%. What are they going to do? Oh, I got Social Security to take care of me. I don't have to save for my retirement anymore. How's that going to work out for you? Maybe for people in our age group here, 30s and 40s, not maybe, for people older than us, maybe there'll be a little bit. You'll get some kind of a check. You know, you might be able to go buy yourself some Wheaties with it or something. People our age, if you are counting on Social Security, you are crazy. You are absolutely crazy. That better not even be a consideration in your mind when you think about the future. When I think about the future, I think Social Security will not be there. I don't think about anything like that. Percentage of American families who have no savings at all, 25%. No savings. They are a flat tire away from complete poverty. They're a flat tire away from being a homeless bum. No savings whatsoever. Well, of course, they got their credit cards they can swipe, right? Average amount saved for retirement, $35,000. This is the average retirement savings in this country, 35 grand. Wow, I hope you don't retire till you're 90 so you can live a whole year off of your lifetime savings. $35,000. Average American household debt, $117,951. So you got people here with 4 grand in their savings account, 35,000 in their IRA, and $118,000 in debt. Average home value in America is $160,000. Well, that's good. They're home. You know, they got all this equity in their home. They really have money. I mean, they could pay off all those debts easily and live for a while. Right. Average amount owed on a home mortgage, $95,000. Well, kind of darn, takes that out. They don't even own half their house. This is the average. So half of them are worse off. Average credit card debt, $2,200. Oh no, I missed one. Average household income, $43,000. That's not so bad. I mean, you could, a small family could live on that. I mean, if you really had to, you'd have to skimp. I mean, it would be tough, but you could do it. Average credit card debt, $2,200. $2,200. I hope you don't have $2,200 on your credit card. Hope you don't have more than that. If you do, I'm going to tell you how to take care of that later on. Percentage of American workers who postponed their retirement age this year, 24%. One quarter of people postponed their retirement this year because they can't retire. It's no wonder interest rates have been at zero for 8 years, 7 or 8 years. So it's, I mean, admittedly, yeah, I mean, if maybe you did have enough to retire on, or you would have had enough 8 years ago, but you've made zero on it and actually lost due to inflation. And then if you were in the market, you probably lost a lot more. And then, so what happens? You know, you're riding the market crashes, you lose it all, you say, I'm getting out of that market, I'm not doing this anymore. So now you just lost half of it, you put it in the bank account, and then you lose the rest over time. It's sad. I mean, and that's not people's faults, really. I mean, it's their fault for electing politicians and the Federal Reserve and that kind of stuff, but I mean, that's not personally their fault. But 24% postponed their retirement, and there's going to be a lot more than that. I hate to tell you, probably none of us are going to retire. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I don't think retirement is really a biblical thing anyway. But I mean, if you think you're going to retire now, today, on Social Security, you're out of your mind. I mean, for goodness sakes, if you're of age to retire and take Social Security, you'd be crazy to do it. Keep working. The thing is, if you're in your 60s, say, and you think, oh, I'm going to retire and take Social Security, I mean, I don't know how you'd live on it anyway. And even if you could manage to live on it for a while, when inflation starts coming in, it's not going to keep up with it. You're not going to be able to live on it. And say you do that for 5 or 10 years, and now you're 70 years old, and now all of a sudden you can't make ends meet. You think you're going to be able to go get a decent job at 70 years old? No, keep working. Keep working for as long as you can work, and put away money, because there are hard times coming, and you'd be crazy to stop working when you can still work. Percentage surveyed who are very confident about having enough money for retirement. 18% of people are very confident about having enough money for retirement. And those people are probably just deluded. I mean, the thing is, if you don't have $500,000 in your retirement account, you better not retire. You got to blow through that in no time. I mean, you could easily blow through that in 10 years, 50 grand a year. I mean, you probably wouldn't have to spend that much if you're retired and you have your house paid off and all that. But still, I mean, you could blow through $500,000 in no time at all, especially when you're not earning any interest on it in the bank. You're earning zero on it, and your cost of living is going up every year. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have $500,000, I wouldn't even think about retiring. Percentage of American adults who do not have a bank account, 7.7%. That's kind of crazy, but there are 8% of people out there that do not even own a bank account. I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I don't think a bank account's a virtue, really. I mean, I think if you have money in the bank, you should probably put it somewhere else where it's safe. But anyway. And the percentage of American adults who have an emergency fund to fall back on, 38%. Just a little over a third of people have an emergency fund to fall back on. What happens if something happens? What happens if you get sick? What happens if you lose your job? What happens if you get into a car accident, your car's broke down, you don't have any way to get to work? I mean, what are you going to do if you don't have an emergency fund? And I'm going to tell you what to do about that and how to rectify that situation. This is a quote from Fox Business. It's an article called Median American Savings, $0. This is from May 4th, 2014, a little over a year ago. It says, a report from Interest.com, part of financial website Bankrate.com, finds the median household savings nationwide is zero, despite the average American having $668 left over each month after paying their bills. The site analyzed data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and found that consumers are spending the leftover cash. I know things are tight, but they're not that tight. What are people doing with their extra $668 per month? They're blowing it on junk they don't need. They're not saving a penny, and they could be. Are you in that category? Could you be saving money, and are you not? I don't care about the rest of Americans out there. I care about you. The median American savings is nothing. Zero. Now, thirdly, we should save to help the poor. It says that he that helps the poor will be blessed. Look at Proverbs 22 and verse 9. And I'm going to get into some practical stuff here soon. I like practical sermons. I mean, you know, I like a lot. I teach a lot of doctrine, obviously. But when it comes to things like this, I don't want to get up here and just harp and say, get out of debt, get out of debt. I want to tell you exactly how to get out of debt. I'm going to tell you how to do it. And if you actually do what I tell you to do, you will get out of debt and you will have money saved. But you have to do what I tell you to do. Proverbs 22 in verse 9. He that hath a bountiful eye shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor. So if you give to the poor, you'll be blessed. You say, well, I don't have any money to give to the poor. Well, God will bless you for doing it. See, there's a return there. Those that honor God have mercy on the poor. Look at Proverbs 14, verse 31. This is one of the things that you should have a little money laid up aside for. You might find somebody less fortunate than yourself that needs help. Proverbs 14 and verse 31. How could that good Samaritan that Steve taught us about this morning, how could that good Samaritan taking care of that poor guy that had fallen among thieves if he didn't have any money? He was carrying a little money with him. He took the guy, poured wine and oil in his wounds, took him to a hotel, gave the money to the hotel guy there and told him to take care of him and come back and I'll pay the remainder of it if there's any more cost incurred to you when I get back. But he couldn't have done that if he didn't have a little money saved up. Now, if he had money saved up in a society back then when everything that you got, you earned with the labor of your two bare hands, which was not much, we have a lot more affluence now. We have a lot more wealth now. We have no excuse for not having money saved up. And I know things are tight for some people, but there's still no excuse for it. Proverbs 14 and verse 31. He that oppresseth the poor reproacheth his maker, but he that honoreth him hath mercy on the poor. See, this is not just a matter of not doing the poor right. This says that you dishonor God if you don't have mercy on the poor. So when we find a legitimate poor person that needs help and we don't help them, we dishonor God. It's not that we just didn't do something nice for our neighbor. And God will repay those who give to the poor. Look at Proverbs 19 and verse 17. Proverbs 19, 17. Says, he that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given will he pay him again. So anytime you give to a poor person, it's as if you're making a loan to God. Do you think God has sufficient means to pay you back? Would you doubt that God, I don't know if I loan God money, I'm not sure if I could trust him to pay me back or not. What are you saying about God? So when you give to the poor, just think about it as if you're saying, Lord, I'm going to loan you some money and I'd like to get it back. Just think about that. And really, you should just do it anyway. Don't worry about getting the money back. But if you do, he'll give it back to you. Proverbs 28 and verse 27, you may be that poor person someday, and it may be get handed back to you. You reap what you sow. Proverbs 28 and verse 27. He that giveth unto the poor shall not lack, but he that hideth his eyes shall have many a curse. You say, oh, I didn't see that. If that good Samaritan would have walked by and been like the Levite and the priest and said, oh, I didn't see that. I don't know what that was. Guess what? Many a curse to him. I don't know what happened to that Levi and that priest, but I'll bet you God was not happy with them because they pretended like they didn't see a need. Now, that doesn't apply when you're reading a, seeing a TV commercial about people right. in Africa. Right. That is not the Good Samaritan thing. No. The Good Samaritan is when you see somebody along your path in your everyday life. That's different than seeing people on the other side of the globe via satellite TV. You couldn't possibly help all those people. There's millions of them. So don't feel like you're under that kind of burden. If you want to give to that kind of stuff, go ahead, but guide your affairs with discretion, as it tells us. We should save, fourthly, we should save to give an inheritance to our children and grandchildren. Look at Proverbs 13:22. That means by the time you check out of this world, you ought to have some money left over, hopefully. Now, maybe you get sick and the medical establishment will drain it all out of you, but hopefully you'd have some left over to give to your children to get them off to a good start. Or even give to them before you check out. Maybe, you know, around the time when they graduate high school or college or when they're out there and they need to get a good start. Good to have a little money laid up if you can. I know sometimes it's not possible, but Proverbs 13 and verse 22 says, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. Now, personally, I believe in performance-based inheritance. I'd say, I mean, if you got kids, you guys got six kids, I mean, if two of them turn out great and the other four turn out lousy and go live with their girlfriends and or drunks or druggies or whatever, I wouldn't give them a penny. I'd give it all to the good kids. That's what I would do. It says, he that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind. I know a person in my own family that ought to inherit the wind. He ought to get nothing. And you know what? My brother stayed there. I had to leave. I left to be a member, be a resident member of the Cincinnati church. I left my dad and he's getting older, and I it was a really hard decision. But my brother is there to take care of him. But you know what? If my dad decides, he says, you know what? Brett stayed here all these years, took care of me, you know, was there for me. And if he decided to give him a majority of it or all of it or whatever, I would be totally fine with that because my brother deserves it. Look at Proverbs 19 and verse 14. House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord. And 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 14 says that the parents ought to lay up for the children, not the children for the parents. So if your idea is, well, my kids will just take care of me when I get old, that's the wrong answer. I mean, they should if they need to, and you got biblical precedent for that, but you should be trying to take care of yourself so you don't burden your children. Leave them an inheritance instead of a big pile of debt. Now, it's foolish to be in debt. You know, sin is called debt, right? Debt is called sin. In Matthew 6, and I'm not going to read these, but Matthew 6, 12, and Luke 11, 4, in the Lord's Prayer, in one place he says, forgive us for our sins, and the other place he says, forgive us for our debts. Debt is sin. Sin is debt. We're to owe no man anything, we're told, in Romans 13 and verse 8. Romans 13 and verse 8 says, owe no man anything but to love one another. He that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. One thing that you can owe somebody is love. You can owe them all the love you need. You can be in debt. Your wife has a huge credit in her account, where you owe her a lot of love. That's okay. But you don't want to owe man anything else. Owe no man anything. You don't want to be in debt. Why? Well, to be in debt is to be a servant. It's to be a slave. Proverbs 22 and verse 7 tells us that to be in debt is to be a servant to a master. Proverbs 22 and verse 7 says, the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. When you take a loan from a bank, you have become a servant to that bankster. If you're in debt, you're a slave to a banker. And we're not supposed to be the servants of men. 1 Corinthians 7:23 says, "Be ye not the servants of men." To be debt-free is to be free. I don't know if you've experienced it before, but it's a wonderful feeling to be debt-free. When you don't have any debt, you get nothing hanging over your head, you don't have to worry, what if I lose my job? How am I going to pay this or how am I going to pay that? You don't have to worry about it. As long as you can get a little bit of food at the grocery store, you're fine. And if you have a little money saved up, you don't have to worry about that. To be debt-free is the way to be. It's foolish to be in debt because you end up paying more for whatever you buy because of interest. You think about that. When you buy things on credit and you make payments on them, you pay interest on that. So ultimately, you're paying more for the item than it's worth. That's stupid. I mean, think about it. Let me give you a practical example. Let's say you go to a furniture store and you can buy a couch. You can buy that couch for $1,000, we'll say. And then there's another furniture store that got the exact same couch. All things are equal. Same couch, they're charging $1,500 for it. And you know that this furniture store charges $1,000. And everything's equal. I mean, it's not like you prefer this store over that store for various reasons. All things are equal. And you, knowing that you can get the couch for $1,000 at this furniture store, intentionally choose to get the other couch for $1,500. What would you say of a person that did something like that? He's an idiot. Why in the world would you pay more for something that you didn't need to? Okay. The couch at the furniture store is $1,000 if you give them the Benjamins for it. If you charge it on the card or take out the store financing, it's going to be $1,500 once you pay on it for all these years. Okay, now let's apply the same logic. What do you call a person that pays $1,500 for a $1,000 couch? An idiot. It's idiocy to take out a loan for something like a couch, especially if you're taking out a loan to start a business or something like that. You're borrowing money to make money. That's different. If you're taking, and I will get into a house. If you take out a loan for a house, sometimes that's a necessary evil because, let's face it, most people probably can't save up enough cash, especially when they're younger to and not doing so well in the world yet, to be able to buy a house with cash. I mean, that's something that's probably not going to happen. So that could be the one exception. I'll get into that stuff later. But anyway, I just wanted to prove the point that it's foolish to buy something on debt because you end up paying more for it in interest. You're paying those miserable banksters again, all that interest, for doing nothing. All they're doing is getting it for free from the Federal Reserve and then giving it to you and collecting interest on it. A person that finances something is an impatient and an uncontent person. You see, the content person is content with what he has. Look at Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. If any of you have financed the couch before, pardon me for offending you. Don't shoot the messenger. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. He says, let your conversation be without covetousness, and look at the converse of covetousness. Be content with such things as ye have. A content person is happy with what he has. He doesn't need anything else to make him happy. He's got enough already. That's a content person. Now, an uncontent person is not happy with what he has and borrows money that he doesn't have to buy something that he wants and probably doesn't need. Most people aren't financing, you know, aren't borrowing money to buy themselves a loaf of bread for the week. They're not borrowing money to probably to pay their rent. They're borrowing money for stuff they don't really need. They're probably not borrowing money to buy clothes to cover their nakedness. They probably have enough clothes to cover their nakedness. They're borrowing money for things that they don't actually need. And that is an uncontent person. Now, contentment is learned. Look at Philippians 4, 11 through 12. This is not a natural tendency. You think any of your kids are content by nature? Of course they're not content. You have to learn to be content. Look at Philippians 4, 11 through 12. Philippians 4, 11 through 12. Not that I speak in respect of want, Paul says, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, to abound, or both to abound and to suffer need. You see, there are two things. I have learned and I have been instructed. It's a learned thing. How does God instruct you? He gives you hardship and you learn to be content with what you have. So in that it's a learned quality, start practicing. We got to learn it. Now, to be in debt and to be a conservative or a libertarian is to be a hypocrite. How can you criticize the government for its deficits and its debt and be in debt yourself? That's called a hypocrite. You need to take the beam out of your own eye before you can take the mote out of Washington, D.C.'s eye. If you're in debt yourself and you're going to say, oh, that darn government, you know, out there spending money they don't have, and you're doing the same thing. Look at Matthew 7, 1 through 5. Matthew 7, 1 through 5. Why is the government spending more than it takes in? Because it is representative of the people which spend more money than they take in. Judge not that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, or in thy government's eye? But considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye. Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote that is in thine eye? Or out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. So you want to get on the government about their debt, get yourself out of debt first, and then you can get on the government about their debt. A person that's in debt is also contributing to his country's demise. You know, every time a loan is made, new money is created, and it inflates and dilutes the money supply. That's how money, every time a loan is taken out, it's not like they're taking money that some other guy gave them and loaning you out his money. No, they're just creating new money out of nowhere. It's called fractional reserve banking. Now, on the other hand, saving money creates reserves that businesses can borrow from and invest in producer goods, which are then used to create consumer goods, which cause economic growth. Producer goods are like machines that produce things that we all like to have. So producer good would be the CNC machine. The consumer good would be the iPhone that the CNC machine mills out the aluminum of or whatever. When companies borrow money, that's a good thing. See, when people save money, then there's money there for companies to borrow from and to invest in capital, to invest in more machines, which make more stuff, which then end up making more consumer goods, which makes the society more abundant, more wealthy. It produces things. That debt produces things. Your debt doesn't produce anything. Borrowing money to spend on consumer goods wastes resources and increases our trade deficit. So any money that you borrow, some corporation couldn't borrow. There's only so much money. Well, sort of. They can kind of create it. They keep creating it. But still, at any one point in time, there's only so much money. And any money that you borrow is not into the productive part of the economy. I know this is a little bit of economic stuff, but anyway. All right, so let's get to the practical tips then. Practical tips on money management. I've got lots of them. Now, before I get into this, I do this stuff myself. I'm not being a hypocrite. I'm not giving you some ideal and, hey, why don't you try this and see if it works it out. I do these things myself, and I have for basically my entire adult life. So I'm not telling you to do anything that I don't do myself, virtually. I don't have a college fund for my kids yet because I don't have any kids. But pretty much all the rest of this stuff I do myself. Rule number one, do not finance anything with the possible exception of a house. If you don't have the cash in hand to buy something, then don't buy it. This is the simplest rule. If you don't have the money, don't buy it. And literally, when I say the money, I don't mean the credit card. I mean the money. If you don't have the green stuff in your hand, don't buy it. You say, well, I won't be able to get it then. Well, then don't get it. Learn to be content with what you have. It's very simple, really. Now, I say with the possible exception of a house, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But pretty much anything else, if you don't have the money, don't buy it. Rule number two, Now you say, well, at this point, I could never do that. I mean, I'm in debt. Okay, well, first we'll get you out of debt, and then you'll learn to only buy things when you have the money. So first things first, we'll get to the debt thing, but let me get to a couple other points first. So rule number two, pay for things with physical cash, not credit. This will make you much more conscious of what you're spending your money on and will help you to keep within your budget. Now, if you don't want to do cash, I'll get you rule number three. But rule number two, I think, works wonderfully. And I didn't used to do the cash thing. I always did the credit card thing and paid it off every day or every week or so, you know, every few days. And that's okay. But if you do the physical cash thing, it's way easier to stay within your budget. If you make yourself a budget, which you should, and I'll talk about that, make yourself a budget and put out X dollars a month for groceries, depending on the size of your family. You just pick a number, $500. I don't know if a family could live on $500 groceries. Probably not, but I don't know. Anyway, we'll just say $500. Here's your budget. Make something reasonable. Maybe you'll have to adjust it a little bit. Maybe you'll think we can do it on $500 and it really takes $6. So make it $500. And give your wife $500 cash and say, honey, this is the money for groceries this month. Don't spend it on anything else. This is all you have. When you go to the grocery store then, you start at just make mental note or make a little note on a piece of paper of how much things cost as you're putting them in your cart. Add them up in your head or use your phone or whatever. And when you get up to the cash register, if you don't have enough money, don't pull the credit card out. You say, well, no steak for tonight. We'll get hamburger instead. Or no hamburger, we'll get beans instead. Or no beans, we'll get ramen noodles or whatever. That would be a bad idea. But anyway, you get what I'm saying. If you don't have the money, you don't buy it. So then you'll start to be more conscious. But what would you do if you were on the cash basis credit card? Just swipe that thing. I'm not worried about it. So using cash will be much easier to stay within your budget. When I was in Cincinnati, I mean, before I got here, I would always use the credit card as cash. And it was fine, and I could control myself, and it worked out just fine. And I thought moving here, when I would be more on a cash basis, that I would hate it. It would be terrible. I love it. I absolutely love it. I don't use a credit card for anything but online purchases, which I rarely buy anything anyway. But anyway, using cash is great. Nothing like being your own bank. It's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. If you use a credit card, use it as cash and pay it off weekly or daily. Don't run up a whole monthly bill on it and then look at it at the end of the month and say, oh my, I went over $300. What am I going to do now? Pay that thing off daily or weekly. And it's easy. We got online banking. You got it on your phone. You got an app. Just log into there. It takes you 2 minutes every day. Just log into the app, pay it off, pay it off, pay it off. At a minimum, pay it off at the end of the month while you're still in the grace period. You don't pay any interest that way. But pay it off daily. That way it's more like cash and you realize and you see what you're spending your money on. And furthermore, it's a good idea. If you're having trouble controlling your spending, write down everything you buy. You'll wear out pencils doing this. But write down every little thing and then you'll start to look at it and be like, wow, this is where my money is going. I didn't know that I spent $100 a month at Starbucks. I didn't know that I'm blowing who knows how much money at what other venues that you do, going to movies or whatever. I'll talk about that kind of stuff in just a second. All right, rule number four, get out of debt as quickly as possible. And I'm going to tell you how to do it. So in order to pay down debt, you first want to stop spending money on unnecessary things. So that's the first thing. You're not going to be able to pay down debt if you don't have any money left over to pay down the debt with. So you got to stop spending money on the unnecessary things. So here are some unnecessary things that I've come up with. Eating out for lunch instead of packing. This could easily save you $220 a month. $10 a day, 22 working days a month. $220 a month. Now, you'd have to spend a little bit on your, you know, leftovers from dinner last night that you're taking to work for lunch or whatever. I mean, that's not free, but still, you're going to save a lot of money. I mean, you probably save $150, $175 a month or something just not going out to eat at work. I would maybe go out to eat once a week at work, if that, whenever I used to work. I would always take food with me. Eating out for dinner. Depending on the size of your family and the frequency that you do it, you could easily spend hundreds of dollars a month going out to dinner. Easily. I mean, no problem, especially if you're going out to decent places and spending $20, $25 a piece. And if you got two of your, four of your, what, I mean, wow, you're spending buku bucks going out to eat. You know, people back in the day never went out to eat. Ask like Judy Hatcher how many times she had gone out to eat by the time she graduated high school. I think she told me she never had gone out to eat ever until she got out of high school. I think that's what I remember. My dad pretty much, like his senior trip, I think was one of the first time he ever went to a restaurant. People didn't used to go out to eat. They didn't have to. That's what I'm saying. You don't have to have this stuff. You may think you do. You don't. If you're in debt, I mean, if you're not in debt and you get your finances in order and you like to go out to eat once in a while, go ahead. But I'm talking about if you're in debt, you need to get out of debt first. Getting coffee or specialty drinks at coffee shops. One drink per day could easily cost you $120 a month. $4 a drink, 30 days a month. Easily $120 a month. And that's just one a day. You're stopping there multiple times a day, my goodness. I mean, I would like to have your Starbucks budget just for like my whole grocery bill. That'd be great. I don't really have a grocery bill, thanks to you, but anyway. Smartphones. Oh, now I'm touching on the nerves, huh? Smartphones could easily cost you $100 a month or more depending on the size of your family. You got two or three of them, you got kids or whatever, if you're crazy enough to give them to your kids, that'll cost you a pile of money. Now, you don't need smartphones. You say, Pastor, you're a hypocrite. You have a smartphone. I didn't say I need a smartphone. I don't need it. I could get rid of it. I didn't have one until fairly recently ago, and I actually do use, I mean, I use it for the video blogs and stuff like that, but I don't have to have it. And if I was in debt and not saving money, I'd get rid of it. And furthermore, it doesn't, well, anyway, that's a side note. My brother gave it to me for free anyway. It wasn't costing him a penny to have it on his cell phone service. He had some plan where he had an extra line. It didn't cost him anything. Now I pay him for it, and he doesn't even know this, but I pay him. I have an automatically, money automatically drafted from my account to his account every month to pay him for it. Pay him more than he actually cost him, but less than it would cost me, so it's a good deal for both of us. But he doesn't know it. That's the neat thing. One of these days he's going to look at his savings account, he's going to have a pile of money in there and not realize where it even came from. But anyway, unless he happens to listen to this sermon, which he probably won't, so anyway. So, but you could get rid of the smartphone if you had to. I mean, it's not a necessity. You don't have to have one. Cable or satellite TV. Getting rid of this filth will not only save your budget, it'll save your soul. That stuff is horrible for you. I haven't had TV for 10 years. I tried to look up and see how much this stuff cost. I don't even know how much it cost. I went on Comcast. I couldn't even find out. They won't even tell you. I'm not sure how you figure out how much it actually costs until you sign up for it, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I mean, what's it cost? 30, 40, 50, 100 bucks a month? I don't know. $200 a month? Are you serious? $200 a month? Wow. I would say, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Anybody that would spend $200 a month on TV is clinically insane. That is madness. So if you're in debt, for goodness sakes, that's an easy $200 to take out. Easy. $200 to have your mind corrupted. Wow, I mean, you could have somebody corrupt your mind for free. You wouldn't have to pay them $200 for it. Internet. Internet's almost becoming a necessity these days, but you wouldn't have to have it. I mean, for the things that you might have to have it for, you could always go to the library. I'm talking, drastic times or drastic measures, right? I mean, you might want to consider that. That costs $45 a month, minimum. That's what I have to pay for lousy service. It is, too. It's terrible. I want to have you come over one of these days. I need you to look at my computer. There's something wrong. It keeps dropping the Wi-Fi out. But anyway. Smoking can cost you hundreds of dollars. Hundreds of dollars. Yeah. Why didn't I should have said, yeah. That was bad timing. Smoking can cost you hundreds of dollars per month and destroy your health. So it'd be better for your health and your budget to stop smoking. If you're in debt. I mean, if you're flush with cash, saving a pile of money, and you want to go smoke yourself into a grave and get emphysema, go ahead. But it would be a good idea to quit. And you say, well, that's easier said than done, Pastor. I know it's easier said than done. It doesn't matter. I mean, does it matter if it's hard or easy? I mean, you still should do it, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if it's hard, and it doesn't matter if I don't have a clue how hard it is. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. So what? I don't know what I'm talking about, but I still know you should quit. I don't know how hard it is. Going shopping for clothes you don't need. I mean, I go shopping probably, I mean, if you annualize it out, maybe on a biannual basis, if that. Rarely. You know, see these pants here? These pants, I mean, do these pants look okay? They don't look too bad, right? Mm-hmm. You know how old these pants are? 15 years? At least, yeah, 12 years probably. I got these things probably when I was in one of my first years of college. Yeah. And they still look okay. No, I mean, it does kind of pay to buy decent quality stuff, because these were decent quality. I normally don't do that. I normally buy cheap junk, you know, but anyway, they do last. But so, go, I mean, if your pastime is just to go shopping and just buy stuff for the fun of it, well, that, if you're in debt, that's not a good idea, obviously. You don't need that stuff. Going out to movie theaters. I mean, what's that cost? At least 10, 12 bucks just for a ticket? And then popcorn and all that stuff. I don't go. I haven't gone really for years. But one time when Eddie Duke came here, he wanted to take me to a movie. But other than that, it's been years and years. But those things are expensive. Just go to Redbox. I mean, it's what, a buck? Is it a dollar or something? I don't really get movies either. But it doesn't hardly cost anything. Professional sports games, those things can be very expensive. And I'm not saying any of this stuff you can never do. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't ever enjoy yourself. But, I mean, you go to those things very often, especially, what, football games. How much does that cost? 75 bucks, maybe? 100 bucks? I don't know. I mean, that's a lot of money. Concerts can be expensive, too. You know, that costs a pile of money. I've never been to one. I wouldn't mind going, but I've been to, like, the symphony-type things. I don't think that's really a concert in most people's mind, anyway. But anyway, I'm just, you know, these are things you can easily cut out. Extra cars and toys, like four-wheelers, motorcycles, boats, snowmobiles, jet skis, all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you're in debt and you need to get out of debt and save money, well, you can save money getting rid of that kind of stuff. So if you're doing any of the previously listed things with any frequency, it's no wonder that you're in debt and struggling to get by. I mean, just look at, I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month if you do any of these things with any frequency. You could easily cut out a ton of money. So if you're in debt and you're not saving, or you're not saving any money, cutting out some of these things will save you, like I said, hundreds of dollars per month that you can put towards paying off debt and or saving money. This is probably going to be a long sermon, but anyway, bear with me. So once you've gotten your spending under control by eliminating wasteful and unnecessary purchases, then start working on paying off your debt. So the first thing you got to do is get your spending under control. Make a budget. That's what you want to do first thing. I have a spreadsheet. Bud gave it to me. He uses it for the financial counseling stuff. If you want it, I'd be happy to send you a copy of it. And you can put in there all of your expenses, you know, whatever your bills are, your monthly expenses, and then see how much money you should have left over at the end of the month. And somehow you'll never have as much left over as you should. It doesn't seem to matter how much you put everything in there you can think of, and it seems like there's still somewhere there's money missing there, is what I found. But anyway, that's what I mean, write down everything. I mean, you start writing down everything you buy, then you'll realize where some of the money goes. But make yourself a budget ahead of time. So, but now let's get to paying off the debt. So here's the trick to it, and I think this will work. Honestly, I've never been in debt before, but I know that these principles will work. And this is like Dave Ramsey stuff, basically. I didn't listen to him, but I've heard sort of what he has to say. Start with your smallest debt first and attack it with a vengeance, putting all of your spare money towards it. So even if it's not your most high interest debt, you think, well, I want to pay off the big one first because I'm paying more interest on it. It's more of a psychological thing. Pick the smallest debt and just attack that thing like crazy. Maybe it's only a few hundred dollars and you've got your budget in order. Now you're not going to Starbucks. You're not going shopping. You're not going to movies, concerts. You got rid of your cable TV and all of a sudden I've got 500 bucks a month. I can start throwing at this debt. First month, that debt is gone. And you have a sense of accomplishment already. Wow, one of my bills is gone. Whatever the smallest one was. Now you got a little bit of momentum. You're like, I can do this. And this is feeling good. Next, you want to attack the debt with the highest interest rate, like credit cards. So you got a credit card you're paying 20% interest on. That's the next thing you want to go to. If you're making minimum payments on a credit card at 20% interest, you are going to be a debt slave for the rest of your life. You will never pay it off, and it's designed that way. So next thing, pay that thing off. So pay off the high interest rate ones next. Paying interest is just wasted money, and making, like I said, minimum payments on a credit card will ensure that you will be a lifelong debt slave. Once you get your smaller and high interest rate debts paid off, then focus all your energy on your big debts, such as mortgages, cars, student loans. And you might want to get some financial advice for this, which would be more advantageous to pay off first. The thing is, though, the bigger ones are the ones you're going to pay the most interest on. So your house mortgage, look at your mortgage payment. I think they break it down, don't they? Almost all of your payment in the first several years is going to be nothing but interest. So any extra you can throw on that mortgage is going to shave years off the end of it. So it makes more sense, even though maybe you think, well, I should pay off the car first. it probably makes more sense to take that extra money you put on the car and put it on the house, because you're saving yourself all the interest in the long run. But you might want to, you know, weigh the odds. I mean, talk to somebody that's good at finances. I'd be glad to go over it, but you may not want me to see your finances, and I understand that. That's okay. But take it to somebody that you can trust. I'm sure Bud and Jean would be happy to talk to you about it. If you don't want them to know about it, well, maybe they could suggest somebody that you could talk to. The money you free up from paying off these smaller debts will allow you to pay more on the larger debts. So when you pay off the smaller debt, you say, oh, sweet, I don't have that $50 credit card payment a month. Now I can go back to Starbucks. No, take the $50 that you don't have to pay anymore and pay that on the other debts. So you keep rolling over that money that you were paying on other debts, paying off the next ones. Now, once you're out of debt, stay out of debt by saving all the money that you were paying on debts. Somehow, before you paid off the debts, you were still making it every month. You had all these debts, but you were still getting by. That means that you can get by on the money that you had minus the debt money, right? So if your income is $2,000 a month and $500 of that per month was going to pay your credit card and your car payment and your student loans and all that, once you get the car, the student loans, the credit card, all that paid off, you've got $500 a month that is no longer going towards debt. Don't just blow that $500 a month. Take that $500, maybe $400 of it. You know, give yourself a little leeway now that you've paid off your debts. Take $400 of that and start saving it. So you don't want to just get to zero. I mean, when you get to all your debts paid off, now you're at zero. You don't want to be at zero. You want to, you know, start increasing. It's not good. You know, mediocrity is not what we're going to strive here for. All right, rule number 5, create a budget and make it automatic. So you want to get the debts paid off. I mean, you want to get the budget created so that you can stop spending unnecessary money on wasteful things. Then get the debts paid off, and then get your budget made automatic once you get the debts paid off. And then do the budget beforehand, but then reevaluate the budget once you get the extra money from getting the debts paid off. Set up, and this is of course my recommendation. I mean, I'm not saying this is book, chapter, and verse, and if you don't do it, well, then you're a sinner or something, but this has worked for me. Set up different bank accounts and automatic transfers to transfer set amounts of money every time you get paid to those different accounts for various things. It's so easy nowadays with online banking. Most of you have steady income coming in. You know, your paycheck is about the same. Mine's not exactly. It's different for me than it used to be. But back in the day with me, I had virtually the same paycheck coming in every month. And it would come in on a Friday, and on Saturday, I had automatic transfers set up, and it would automatically transfer different amounts of money to different accounts. And those different accounts were either for savings or for paying bills or whatever. And I will give you some examples of this. When you make it automatic, it's so easy. And the money's not there as a temptation to spend. Make yourself one of your account, make that your bill money account. That's what I've done. Your bill money is the money that you're spending month to month, you know, day to day. That's your money. Everything else in these other accounts isn't your money. It is, but it's not. You think about it as not being your money. It's already gone. It's already used for something else. And then that way you don't have a temptation to spend it. So, number one, you want to make an account for God's money. I recommend 10%, and you can listen to that Giving to God series as to why I personally do 10%. Remember, we've already read it in Proverbs 3, 9 through 10, God gets the first fruits. Give unto the Lord of thy first fruits, or give unto the Lord of thy substance, and the first fruits of all that increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. If you give to God of your first fruits, of all your increase, he promises to bless you with abundance. Do you want to get out of debt and you want to save money? Start giving to God, and he promises to give you abundance. I'm not preaching a prosperity gospel here, but he does. He says, so shall your barns be filled with plenty, and your presses shall burst out with new wine. And I've seen this happen in the lives of people in this church. I've seen them do this, and I've seen them be prospered. I've seen it in my own life too. Now, listen to this. The reason that some Christians don't do this is because they obviously don't believe that God will do what he says he will. That's what it comes down to. You don't believe God. Because if God says, give unto me and I will give you abundance. If you really believe that, of course you'd give unto him. I mean, if I told you, give me $100 today and I promise you in a very short amount of time, I will return you $500. Now, if you believed what I said, anybody in this room, would you not give me $100? If you really believed that I would give you the $500 later? Of course you would. I mean, that's an awesome return on investment, right? Now, if I was a shyster and you're like, I don't know about this guy. I've heard of these kind of schemes before. I don't believe him. Then you're not going to do it, right? God says, if you'll allow me the latitude, give me $100. I'll give you $500 in a short time from now. I'm not saying that he's going to do those numbers and that ratio or anything like that. I'm just using it by way of an example. Now, if you really believed God, you say, well, of course. I'm going to give to, I mean, he says he's going to bless me with abundance. Well, that's a good way to get yourself out of debt. It works. It really does. I mean, I've done it. I'm telling you. I'm not just making this up. Now, if you skimp on God, on the other hand, then you're not going to prosper. Look at Haggai 1, 3 through 9. So it really comes down to a matter of faith. Do you believe what God says or not? And it is faith. I mean, boy, I'll tell you. I mean, if finances are tight, it is an act of faith to say, okay, Lord, I'm going to do this, and I'm trusting you're going to take care of me because, boy, this does not look good to me at all. It is an act of faith. It really is. Look at Haggai. Haggai 1, 3 through 9. And like I told you before, I am not trying to fill my wallet by preaching this stuff to you. And if you think I'm a shyster, give it to somebody else, but still give it to God. Give it to another preacher, give it to the poor, or whatever. I'm not trying to fill my wallet. And I've already told you, I am extremely thankful for how well this church supports me. But if there are individuals that need to hear it, you need to hear it still. Haggai 1, 3 through 9. It says, Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai. Or Haggai, the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain. How far did I want to read? Yeah, to verse 9. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. You looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts? Because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man to his own house. This is exactly the opposite of Proverbs 3, 9, and 10. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10 says, you give to the Lord, he'll fill your barns with abundance. This one says, these people were not giving to the house of God, and God says, you're bringing home lots of money, lots of stuff, and it's just disappearing. It's like you've got a bag with holes in it. What's happening here? You're not giving to me, God says, and therefore, you want to blow your money? Well, I'm blowing your money. The Lord will blow upon it. So do you feel like you're always struggling to get by? God says, consider your ways. Do you wonder why you can't ever seem to get ahead? God says, consider your ways. Do you wonder why you can't ever seem to get out of debt? God says, consider your ways. Now, once again, if people actually believed what Haggai said, and if they believed in it, and when God says, hey, you don't give to me, I'm going to take from you, you better believe they give to him. If it's a choice between, I know, hey, I either give to God or else God starts siphoning off $300 a month out of my bank account, well, that's a no-brainer. But they don't believe it.
That's right.
They don't believe it. If you believe God, well, do what he says and see what happens. All right, general savings. So you want to have your bank account set up for God's money. And just pick your percentage, whatever that is, whatever you've decided in your heart, and have that amount automatically transferred into that bank account and then give to the Lord out of that bank account. And then you make the decision one time and it's done. It's not every month where you're prying the money out of your wallet and saying, I don't know if this is going to work out. Just do it one time and that's all it takes. General savings. I would have another account. I'd recommend 10%. Like I said, I mean, these are just my recommendations, but 10%. This can be your rainy day fund for when unexpected things come up, such as house repairs, health costs, child-related costs, those kind of things. I mean, you can easily just have unexpected things come up, which cost hundreds or thousands of dollars. And when you have that money already laid aside for that, there's nothing to worry about. You can sleep easy at night. You have peace. You don't have to worry. This fund will give you peace in case of a job loss. Think, what happens if I lose my job? Well, if you get some money laid aside, nothing's going to happen. You're going to go out there, you know, beat the bushes and find another job before your rainy day fund runs out. You should have savings enough to hold you over for at least 3 months without a job. Anybody here have a 3 month pile of cash that you could live on for 3 months without a job? That's what people recommend. That's what I recommend. It's a good idea because you never know what could happen. All right, house fund. Now, if you already have a house, your house fund is at the bank. You're just sending them money to your house fund. And that's, you know, like I said, that's okay, depending. But if you're renting, this is my recommendation once again, take it or leave it. But if you're renting, rent the cheapest, decent place that you can find and save money for a house if you want one. To me, it doesn't make sense if your ultimate goal is to get a house to go out there and rent a $1,500 a month apartment. That doesn't make any sense to me. You're never going to be able to save any money that way. I doubt it. I mean, that's going to be as much or more than your mortgage is. So you go and you try to find a cheap place like I have. $700. I think it's really expensive, to be honest with you. I was paying $420 in Cincinnati. But anyway, that's about as cheap of a decent place as you can find around here. You're probably not going to find much for less than that. So do that and save as much money as you can. Save at least 20% of the value of the house that you want for a down payment. Now, this may offend somebody, but I don't care. If you put down less than 20% on a house, it means that you can't afford the house. You've bought too much house if you can't put down 20% on the house. Before we lived in the Twilight Zone, banks required a 20% down payment. Now, since 2000 and whatever, since the early 2000s when we got into the Twilight Zone, all of a sudden, we don't need 20% down. We don't even need anything down for that matter. I mean, housing prices are just going to continue to rise. What do you need a down payment for? Now it's 3% or 5% or whatever. The reason why banks wanted 20% is because then somebody's got some skin in the game. And then they're not going to walk away from a house whenever something happens. But now you put just a few percent down. Once you do the closing costs and all that stuff, I mean, you're already underwater when you sign the document. So if something happens, what are you going to do? You're going to quit paying on the mortgage. It wouldn't make any sense if you lost your job or something. So anyway, that's why banks used to require 20% down. All right, a car fund. Bank account for a separate car fund. I think I've told you this before, but this is an excellent idea. I do this myself. I've never had a car payment in my life. I've paid cash for every car I've ever owned, except for my mom bought me a car when I was 16, I think, a little $1,000 clunker. But after that point, I've never had a car payment. I've always paid cash for cars. I don't drive nice cars, obviously, but I don't have car payments either. Make your, quote, car payment to your car fund, to your separate bank account, and you'll never have to have an actual car payment again because you'll be able to pay cash for a car. You say, but what if I already have a car payment? I can't afford to make my payment to the car fund and to the bank. Well, we'll get into that. So you can use this fund also to cover repairs for your car as they come up so that you're not scrambling to find money every time something happens to your car or putting it on a credit card. So whenever, you know, your transmission blows up and you got to drop a grand on the car, you're not scrambling to get $1,000. You've already got that in your car fund. You just take it out of there and you're all right. Now, if you're currently financing a car, pay it off as quickly as possible. And then when it's paid off, then make that same payment to your car fund. So if your car payment's $300 a month, pay that thing off, make that old car run as long as you can, and then take that $300 after you paid it off and put that in your car fund every month. Automatically, out of your paycheck, you're making the same payment. You'll never notice the difference. It was going to the bank, used to be going to the bank, now it's going to your own bank account. And then you'll pile that money up in there, and then you can buy your next car with cash. And then just keep putting that $300 in there every single month, and you'll never have to finance another car again. And you're not paying interest on it. You may have to put less than that $300. You may be able to put $200 a month in there. You'll never have to have a car payment again. It works. I do it. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. It works. Now, if you have an expensive car that isn't paid off yet, consider selling it and buying a less expensive car that you can pay off more quickly so that you can begin saving money to pay cash for the rest of your cars for the rest of your life. You only have to suffer for just a few years. And I say suffer. These are first world problems. When you're suffering, you know, by trying to pay off your car and not having a car payment. But if you just suffer for a few years, pay that car off, and then start making payments to yourself, You'll never have a car payment for the rest of your life, and you'll never even feel it. Nothing. It's great. Now, if you want to make your pastor happy, inform me someday that you just bought a car with cash. I will be so happy. Don't tell me how great the sermon was. Don't tell me how much you appreciate me. Don't tell me any of that stuff. Come up to me someday and say, "Pastor, I just bought a car with cash." That'll make me probably happier than anything that you could tell me. All right, a car insurance fund. So I have a separate bank account for car insurance. You could use your car fund if you wanted to, but I have a separate one for car insurance. Automatically put a little bit of it into your account every paycheck, and you'll never be surprised whenever that biannual car insurance bill comes up. When it's $300, you're like, "Oh, what am I going to do? I don't have the money." You've got the money in that account. You know, when you're putting $50 a month into that account or whatever, $50 a month would be $300 every 6 months. Yeah, so you just make that payment. And also, you'll save money because you're not paying your car insurance every month. If you pay it every 6 months, you save money. You know, they give you a discount for paying it every 6 months. So if you're paying it month to month, you're actually paying more for your car insurance. So just start putting that money aside, and then every month, that's what I do, whenever the 6 month comes, I just write them a check out of that account, and it's not like, "Oh boy, where am I going to get the money for the car insurance?" A vacation fund. By automatically putting a little bit into this account every paycheck, then you have money to go on a vacation. Now, if this fund is empty, guess what? Don't go on vacation. It's real easy. So if you don't, I mean, I would make the vacation fund probably lower on your list of priorities. If you don't have it, don't go on vacation. Financing a vacation is a mark of insanity. That's crazy to take out a loan to go on vacation. You obviously need to work more if you need to take a loan out to go on vacation. You haven't worked enough. You don't deserve a vacation. You say, how can you say you don't deserve a vacation? If you can't afford to pay for it out of cash, you don't deserve a vacation. That's what I'm saying. College fund. It'd be a good idea to set a little money aside every month for your children, for each of them. If you could create separate bank accounts for each of them, that'd be a good idea. Put a little bit of money in there. Maybe you can't afford to put much. Maybe you can't afford to put any at a certain point. But if you can, as you can, if you've done the things that I've told you to do, then maybe you will be able to put a little bit in there. Even if it's $10 a month for each kid or something, it'll add up over time. You may not be able to put them through college, but maybe they'll have a few $1,000 by the time they get ready to graduate, and you can hand them that, and they can get a good start on life or something. So that would be a good thing to do. And since this would obviously be a long-term savings thing, I would recommend putting that money in gold or silver or something like that that'll preserve the purchasing power of it. When you get a raise, and I mentioned this last time, don't change your spending habits at all. Just rather save that extra money proportionally in your different accounts. Just redo your automatic bank account transfers. This is what I used to do every time I get a raise. Redo the automatic transfers, and it would just siphon more money into all the different accounts, and I just keep on living like I'd always lived. Now, if your cost of living has gone up, you may need to spend a little bit more than you were before. That's kind of the idea of the cost of living raise, but if you can, just keep living on what you've always lived on. It doesn't make any sense if you get a big raise and then just redo your cost of living or your living standards, and your raise, it didn't help you any in the long run. It didn't help you save any money. It didn't help you pay down any debt. It just helped you to acquire a bunch more junk you don't need. Start this as soon as you get your first job, and you will not be a lifelong debt slave like the rest of the serfs in our society. So Chris, James, tell them, make sure Amanda listens to this sermon, if you will, because she needs to hear this stuff too. But if you do this, from the time you get your first job, you're not going to be like the rest of the people in our society. You're not going to be in debt the rest of your life. Start off and do these things from the very beginning as you are able, obviously. I'm just going to throw this out there, taking out a 30-year mortgage so that you can write off the interest on your taxes is stupid. It's stupid if you're doing it for the purpose of writing it off on your taxes. Maybe a 30-year mortgage is what you have to do. But to say, "Oh, well, I'm going to do a 30-year, that way I can write off the interest on the taxes," that's asinine, and I'm going to tell you why. Only a moron would spend 100% to save 30%. If you don't believe me, give me $100 and I'll give you $30 back. I mean, it'll be a sweet deal. Oh, I'm saving $30 by giving the pastor $100 and he's going to give me $30 back. Did you really save $30 or did you lose $70? Yeah. You don't get back all the interest you paid on the mortgage on your tax refund. I think some people think that, oh, if I pay $1,000 a year in interest, I just get all that money back on my taxes. No, you don't. You just don't pay tax on that money. You don't get it all back. It's not like anything you spend on interest, you get it. That's not how it works. You simply don't pay income tax on the amount that you paid in interest. Last page. Everybody's breathing a sigh of relief. So if you paid, let me give you an example. If you paid your banker master $1,000 in interest, you don't have to pay your government master 30% of that $1,000 in income tax. So if you paid $1,000 in interest to your banker master, you saved $300 on your taxes to your government master for a net loss of $700. Okay, so you spend $1,000 in interest, and then the government says, okay, well, you spend $1,000, you don't have to pay tax on that $1,000, so you're not gonna pay $300 in taxes that you would have. So the government, you're gonna pay $300 less in taxes, but you spend $1,000 in order to save the $300 on taxes. So you have a net loss of $700. Now, if you would have paid $0 in interest to your banker master and paid the $300 to your government master, you would only have a net loss of $300. So it's not a matter of ever gaining. You're never going to gain, but you're going to lose less if you didn't pay the interest on the loan. You're going to lose less. Now, maybe you just hate the government so much, you'd rather spend $700 to save giving them $300. You know, I mean, if that's your thing, I mean, if you do anything not to send them tax money, even cost yourself personally, well, I guess go ahead. But, you know, I dislike them, but I don't dislike them that much. I mean, come on. It doesn't make financial sense to spend $1,000 to save $300. Like I said, if you don't agree, give me $1,000, I'll give you $300 back. It'll be a great deal for me anyway. Okay, so here's my fear. My fear is that you're not going to listen to a thing that I've said. You're going to sit here, you're going to nod your head and say, yep, boy, you're right, Pastor. Uh-huh, yep, that's right on. Preach it, brother. And you're going to go out of here and you're going to do the same thing that you've always done. You're going to keep on piling more debt and saving little to nothing. That's what my fear is. Kids, please listen to me and take heed before you embark on a lifelong journey of serfdom and debt slavery. You guys haven't started yet. Don't start. I've got good hope for you guys, because you haven't started yet. Chances are, though, you won't listen to me either. I'm just a lonely preacher, fighting against a world of banksters, politicians, media, commercials, teachers, parents, and peers. Let me read you another quote, lyrics from another one of my favorite Johnny Cash songs. And you can still hear me singing to the people who don't listen. To the things that I am saying, praying someone's gonna hear. And I guess I'll die explaining how the things that they complain about are things they could be changing, hoping someone's gonna care. I was born a lonely singer, and I'm bound to die the same. But I've got to feed the hunger in my soul. And if I never have a nickel, I won't ever die ashamed, because I don't believe that no one wants to know. I believe that there's somebody out there that wants to know, and that's why I keep on harping on these things. Now, if you think I'm being ridiculous, and you're like, Pastor, that was below the belt. Why would you say that your fear is that none of us are going to listen to a thing that you said? You don't have any confidence in us. That was just cruel and mean. Why would you even say that? If you think I'm being ridiculous, then prove me wrong. Prove me wrong. That is my challenge to you. Prove me wrong. Come to me in the future and tell me, Pastor, I created a budget and stopped wasting money. Come to me and say, Pastor, I paid off my credit card. Come to me and say, Pastor, I paid off my car loan. Come to me and say, Pastor, I just paid cash for a car. Now, I know this is in the future. This is a long ways from now, but that's okay. Pastor, I just saved 20% down payment on my house. It was a lot of money, too. And I saved it up. Pastor, I just paid off my house. I got rid of that thing. Mortgage, that is. Pastor, I'm now debt free. Prove me wrong. Come and tell me these things. I saved up a 3-month emergency supply fund. I've set up multiple bank accounts and automatic transfers to save for various things. Come to me and tell me that. And if the majority of you do that, I will publicly apologize and admit that I was wrong. I will stand up here and put it on tape and put it on the internet and say, I was wrong. You people listened to me. You got yourselves out of debt. You started saving money. You took care of yourselves. And I was a fool forever doubting it. I will admit that I was wrong in front of everybody, repent in sackcloth and ashes. I will even wear, if I could find sackcloth in that day, I would wear sackcloth and put ashes on my head if the majority of you come and tell me those things. Now, if you refuse to heed this instruction, don't be surprised if you end up in poverty. And here's the closing verse, Proverbs 13 and verse 18. Proverbs 13. And verse 18. It says, poverty and shame shall be to him that refuseth instruction, but he that regardeth reproof shall be honored. So if you refuse the instruction, poverty and shame are awaiting you. Thank you for your kind and patient attention.